Australia's always been the lucky country, sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, Andrew West with the Religion and Ethics Report here on ABC Radio National. Wokeness. It's a word that's gone from badge of pride to insult. It's an idea with religious roots, even though many of its champions would disdain any religious belief. Those who've embraced wokeness say they're promoting social justice. But to author Musa Al-Gharbi, it's social justice for those who want to feel progressive but cling to the status of the upper middle class. His book is We Have Never Been Woke: The Cultural Contradictions of a New Elite.
One of the things I show in the book is that the constellation of kind of attitudes and ways of engaging in politics that people describe as, quote, woke, are primarily held by people who are relatively affluent, highly educated, urban and suburban white people, and they're pretty alienating to almost everyone else. Over the course of the Great Awakening that started after 2010, the Democratic Party shifted a lot to kind of mirror the preferences and priorities of knowledge economy professionals, whose views shifted a lot, in ways that put them out of touch with a lot of the rest of America. And so if you look at whose votes shifted from 2020 to 2024, you can see that the people whose votes shifted towards the Republican Party, that is, the people whose votes who were most responsible for the re-election of Donald Trump, were people who were ethnic minorities, religious people, less educated and less affluent people. Mm-hmm. Even in terms of gender, Kamala Harris got the lowest vote share of the female vote. She got the lowest vote share of women of any Democratic candidate other than John Kerry going back 30 years. And so the people whose vote shifted the most towards the GOP were actually the less, quote, privileged people. Those are the people who got alienated the most and shifted towards the Republican Party, even as rich people, highly educated people, well, privileged people shifted towards the Democrats.
Yeah, and Musa, just to back up your point, I should point out there was a terrific piece, you probably saw it in the New Left Review by Matthew Karp, which went through the data in the way that you have. One thing that struck me was, I mean, you say it right there on page 121, that the right-wing backlash rarely occurs against material improvements for the poor. So what is the backlash against? Because it's not a neoliberal backlash, an economic neoliberal backlash. People aren't voting for unfettered free markets and against labor unions, are they?
And in fact, one of the ways that Trump positioned himself in an unusual way compared to other Republican candidates was that both Trump and Vance position themselves as being kind of more friendly with labor unions than Republicans typically have been. They have a more protectionist posture on trade, for instance, advocating for things like tariffs in a way that is far out of step with the Republican orthodoxy. They have a restrictionist view of immigration, which runs in contrast with, say, the preferences of people like the Koch brothers, who want these kinds of unfettered movement of people and resources across borders and so on. Even if you look at the Republican posture, it's unusual relative to the positions Republicans have struck in previous elections. The thing that's driving the backlash, to the extent that they're dissatisfied with the Biden administration's economic policies, it's because they haven't done a good enough job of leveraging the state to address social problems. It's not because what they want is radical free market solutions and deregulation and all of this kind of stuff. And the thing that's driving the backlash is, it seems like, cultural issues. Like, growing numbers of people increasingly feel like the Democratic Party and institutions like higher ed and journalism and so on, which are closely aligned with the Democratic Party, these institutions don't represent their values and their interests, that the people who run those institutions hate people like them, don't respect them, and so on. And so this feeling of cultural alienation and sociological distance, that's what seems to be driving the backlash, both in this instance and also in previous instances of backlash against awokenings.
Yeah, you call your book We Have Never Been Woke. I've read a lot of reviews in this book, cover stories in The New Yorker and The Atlantic. The one criticism I did note, Musa, is that one critic said you don't define the term woke.
The term is much contested. I didn't think it was actually useful, given that there's a lot of people who argue over the meaning of the word. I didn't think it was useful to like pave over those disagreements and just pick a definition that's most congenial to my own purposes. Instead of doing that, what I do is I surface the different ways that different people have tried to understand the term. I look over time at the history of the term. I look at the trajectory of similar words like political correctness that have served a kind of similar function. I look at different attitudes and beliefs that people across the political spectrum seem to be loosely gesturing towards when they use the word woke. I provide a lot of context in this way that I think provides a much richer understanding of what the term means to different stakeholders.
Yeah, when you say
it's more valuable.
Yeah, when you say though, Musa, loosely gesturing, I mean, there actually is real gesturing, because how much of so-called wokeness is performative? It can't be a mindset change only. You've got to let people see what you're doing and be performative about it, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a big part of wokeness are these kinds of symbolic gestures. And that makes sense, because the people who are most likely to subscribe to, quote, wokeness are this group of people that I call symbolic capitalists. They're people who work in jobs like media and HR and law and finance and consulting. So they're people who make a living on the production and manipulation of symbols and data and so on. And so for us, our lives and our livelihoods are literally dependent on our mastery over symbols and on displaying and portraying ourselves and other people the right way and so on. We take these symbolic things very seriously in a way that's unusual compared to most other people. And so like a big part of wokeness, because wokeness is primarily the ideology of this kind of subset of elites who make a living on symbols, then yeah, a huge focus of wokeness is symbolic stuff, like these symbolic gestures and making sure, again, as you well put it, that when you strike the proper symbolic gesture, everyone knows and recognizes the correct symbolic gesture. And if you notice that other people are not striking the right gesture or not striking the gesture in the right way, then you can use that as a means of marking those people in various ways as being not fit, not being part of the right group.
Musa, how does wokeness trace its roots back to religion, and almost specifically Calvinism and the Reformation?
I mentioned before that wokeness is kind of the ruling ideology of this group of elites I call symbolic capitalists. Well, what's interesting is these professions like journalism and law and so on were originally created as sinecures for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, especially men, so for WASPs, as we call them. And the kind of ideology that prevails in these institutions really has this kind of flavor that's derived from Protestantism. So as I talk about in the book, when you look at the beginning of these professions, when they started defining themselves, saying that the autonomy that we enjoy, the high pay that we enjoy, the prestige that we enjoy, the reason you should give us these things is because of all the social good that we're going to do, because it'll be to the good of everyone, because we're going to help everyone in society. We really relied heavily on this messaging from what was called the social gospel movement at the time, a Protestant kind of Calvinist-derived set of religious beliefs and ideas about transforming society for the betterment of all. And so there is this kind of interesting relationship between wokeness and this religious ancestry. And actually, when you look at the people who are the most likely to subscribe to, quote, woke beliefs, the people who are most likely to adopt this kind of woke approaches to politics and who are most likely to be critical of things like compromise and working across the aisle and so on, who have a kind of militant approach to progressive politics, tend to be post-religious Protestants. So people who are of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant background, but who are themselves no longer religious and seem to be in some important senses kind of substituting politics for religion. One thing that I try to push back on a little bit in the book, though, there are some people who make arguments that I don't find particularly helpful about the relationship between Calvinism and wokeism. Namely, they say things like, wokeism is in some ways derivative of the Puritans, and the Puritans were bad, therefore wokeness is bad. Wokeness is like a religion. Religion sucks, therefore wokeness sucks. As a religious person, as a Muslim, those kinds of arguments don't really jive with me that well. But again, I think there's definitely a way to talk about this kind of interesting set of relationships between wokeness and Protestantism that really can shed a lot of interesting light on this phenomenon.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West. We're speaking with Dr. Musa Al-Gharbi. He's the author of a much acclaimed new book, We Have Never Been Woke, The Cultural Contradictions of the New Elite. Well, Musa, let me ask you about yourself, because you tell your own story in the book. You're an African-American, a convert to Islam. Let's be frank, how much of this is a license? Because you say this, how much of this of your own background is a license to write a book critiquing this cultural upper middle class?
Yeah. Like, the book is in some ways a physical embodiment of some of the contradictions that it highlights and criticizes. So for instance, one of the things the book criticizes is the use of credentials, especially elite credentials, to decide which voices are worth taking seriously, who you can safely ignore, and so on and so forth. But it's also the case that I went out and published this book with Princeton University Press. I targeted prestige university presses.
Yes, and it's University of New South Wales Press, New South Press in Australia too, by the way.
Oh, yes, yes. And the reason they were interested in me was because I was coming from Columbia University, another Ivy League school. Like, if I had written the exact same manuscript but pitched it coming from University of North Dakota, I probably wouldn't have even gotten a response. On top of that, it's also the case, like, the book highlights and criticizes the ways that elites often use their association with historically marginalized and disadvantaged groups, this kind of identitarian stuff, in order to be taken more seriously and to gain access to resources and opportunity. So they leverage these collective identities in the service of their personal profit. It's also true that part of the reason this book was published at all, part of the reason it was an attractive project for Princeton, was because I'm a Black Muslim writer who publishes in outlets like The Guardian. If I had been a cisgender, heterosexual, white male, and especially if I had any hint of conservatism or evangelical Christianity or something like that about me, then it's probably the case that, one, the book probably wouldn't have been published at all. The exact same manuscript, I could have submitted it and it probably would have been rejected because it would have been viewed as too risky. Or if they decided to run with it at all, I would have probably been subject to a lot of sensitivity readers and really heavy-handed editing and stuff like that. Like, part of the reason why I was able to just speak honestly and go pew, pew, pew about the things I believe is in part because I'm a Black Muslim.
Yeah.
And so even though the book criticizes and highlights and really catalogs in great detail how this kind of game plays out, but it's also a product of this very game. Like, the book wouldn't have probably been published in its current form or enjoyed the reception that it did if I was a straight white man or if I was coming from a less elite school.
Your background does give you, though, this very sharp insight into the division between these elites, these symbolic capitalists, and a part of America that they thought they sort of had tied up in that sense, which is minority communities, ethnic minority communities. But where does that disdain or that suspicion of religion among symbolic capitalists bring them undone with minority communities?
It's a big part of the problem, both for the Democratic Party and for institutions of knowledge production like higher ed and journalism and so on. The fact is, most people in the United States and worldwide, actually, are religious. And religion is an important part that informs everything from who they vote for to family formation to just so much of our lives is informed by these fundamental beliefs and commitments, who we associate with, where we live. And so to the extent that a lot of scholars and journalists and other people just don't really know anything about religion or respect religion, or, you know, it makes it tough for them to really understand the social world, for one. And two, it alienates people. So to the extent that people perceive, not wrongly in many cases, that academia or journalism or the Democratic Party and so on is hostile, disrespects their fundamental commitments and values, they tend to react very negatively to that for understandable reasons and try to resist and dismantle and so on these institutions. And this matters especially for the minority vote because non-white people are relative to whites, and especially relative to affluent, highly educated sorts of whites. But even if you just look at baseline white people as a whole, racial and ethnic minorities are more likely to be religious. They're more likely to be socially conservative on cultural issues, which in part derives from their religion, especially compared to like the highly educated, relatively affluent crowd. They're more likely to be patriotic and nationalistic. They're more likely to favor things like tradition and social order. A lot of African Americans, and this is one of the ways that progressives often go wrong on talking about issues like crime, although many are dissatisfied with policing and law enforcement, they don't necessarily want less policing. According to the polls and surveys, they actually want the same amount or more policing, just better policing. And this is in part because a lot of African Americans, especially less elite African Americans, have real concerns about public safety and public order. Not only are they disproportionately likely to suffer from bad policing when bad policing occurs, they're also disproportionately likely to suffer from crime. Yeah. It's easy for people who live lives that are relatively insulated from that, who live in safe communities and buildings with doormen, and who have private security at the institutions they work and so on, to be disdainful about concerns about public safety and public order. But for less affluent people, non-white people and so on, these are things they care about a lot. In these respects and many more, the fact that knowledge economy professionals and aligned institutions and our preferred political party, the Democratic Party, the fact that we're so distant from most of the rest of the country in many cultural dimensions, including religion, is a very big problem. It alienates people from us and from our institutions and prevents us from understanding other people and where they're coming from and what they're about.
Musa, why do the multimillionaires and the billionaires, the people whom you might think would be opposed to quote-unquote wokeness, why are they happy with it? Why doesn't it bother them?
One thing that's important to understand is that the millionaires and the billionaires are increasingly drawn from the population of people who subscribe to wokeness in the first place. So again, wokeness is primarily embraced by knowledge economy professionals, people who work in tech and finance and HR and consulting and so on. The millionaires and the billionaires are increasingly drawn from the same group of people. If you look at the 10 richest people in the world, according to Forbes, you'll notice that 8 out of the 10 are American. And of the Americans, pretty much all of them are symbolic capitalists. If you just look at the richest 10 Americans, all 10 are symbolic capitalists, with a partial exception. The only true capitalist in America who falls on either of those lists, traditional capitalist, is Elon Musk. His businesses are primarily involved with providing physical goods and services to people. So Tesla is an auto manufacturing company. SpaceX is a shipping and logistics company. The Boring Company is about materials extraction. So he's a traditional capitalist. But even Elon Musk made his first hundreds of millions in two symbolic industries. He did Zip2 and then PayPal. That's how he got his start. And if you look at where most of his investments are right now, they're also in symbolic industries. He's investing a lot in UX with Neuralink. He has a telecom company, Starlink. He's investing a lot in AI and so on. And so even the one exception helps prove the rule. Yeah. If you want to look at who the millionaires and the billionaires are, who the oligarchs are, who the contemporary aristocracy is, it's symbolic capitalists. It's the symbolic industries. That's where all the action is.
Yeah.
So part of the reason why the millionaires and the billionaires embrace wokeness is because wokeness is the ruling ideology of the kind of people who become millionaires and billionaires today.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report, we're speaking with Musa Alghabi about his new book. It's a bestseller in the US. It's We Have Never Been Woke, The Cultural Contradictions of a New Elite. One of the things that I guess makes wokeness, in inverted commas, so inoffensive, as it were, to the multimillionaires and the billionaires, is that it doesn't cost them anything. You actually get a lot of kudos if you set up a pride network in your organization or you start a minority internship program. You get a lot of kudos for that. And maybe people look the other way if you don't pay workers downstream in developing countries that well.
Yeah, absolutely. It can serve this important moral licensing and moral credentialing function. A lot of these symbolic gestures, as you said, they don't cost much, but they do provide benefits in terms of status and people viewing you as ethical and so on. And I'll add, this isn't just the domain of the billionaires and the billionaires. This is also true of the upper middle class folks who work in the symbolic professions. And in fact, one of the things I try to argue in the book is that even if we want to understand how the millionaires and billionaires exercise power, we really have to look at the role that professionals play. We're the ones who make stuff happen. There's this other book by Anand Giridharadas called Winners Take All. And he says, well, look, you know, the millionaires and the billionaires and multinational corporations create all of these problems in the world through their kind of single-minded, myopic pursuit of profit maximization. And then they leverage big philanthropy to paint themselves as the solutions to the problems that they themselves created. It's a good book. But the thing about it is, like, when you pay attention to, like, how does that stuff actually happen? Like, who is it that's doing all the PR work to help the billionaires avoid blame for social problems and to help them get credit for this reputation laundering after they make donations? Oh, well, the symbolic capitalists run the PR firms.
Yeah.
Who are the journalists who write the puff pieces that help them accomplish this goal? Oh, well, that's us too. Oh, well, who is it that administers these nonprofits through which they launder? Oh, that's us too. Who is it that helps move the money around and move the paperwork around to like working in finance and law and stuff? Oh, that's us too. Almost every single part of this story that Giridharadas describes, the millionaires and the billionaires don't actually do anything. The symbolic capitalists are the ones who are making stuff happen. And again, the millionaires and the billionaires are themselves increasingly symbolic capitalists as well. But we can set that to the side.
Yeah. Look,
and then even when you look at politicians.
Oh, let's not go there for the moment. But look, the thing that struck me, Musa, is this is a very easy book to read. But at various points, I felt I was about to collapse with exhaustion just picturing the lives of symbolic capitalists. How competitive are their lives? It's just exhausting when you think about the virtue signaling or the actual work that they have to do to keep their jobs. How competitive is this?
Yeah, I mean, and this is one of the differences, actually, between the contemporary elite and other types of elites, is today, most of the people who are elites work, they have jobs, and they spend like 40, sometimes 60 hours a week doing those jobs. That's the source of their wealth. And this is different from previous iterations of elites. And as a result of the fact that most of us work and that we often have these really competitive things, like in order to become a writer for the New York Times, for instance, it's a rat race from a very early age, starting in K-12 schools. You know, a lot of them have their time heavily managed, like as John Haidt in Coddling of the American Mind or Annette Leroux in her book Unequal Childhood stresses. People from these kinds of professional managerial class backgrounds, their childhoods are highly structured from a very early age. They have sports and extracurricular activities. They do all this homework. They have this kind of race to try to get into the, quote, good K-12 schools that their parents often invest a lot of money to live in the right neighborhoods and make sure they have the right test prep to get into the right K-12 schools. And then they hustle throughout their whole time in K-12 education to build up the right extracurriculars and get the right letters of recommendation and make sure they get high GPAs and high scores on standardized tests in order to get into an elite school. And then when they're in the elite school, they try to make sure that they build up the right credentials
well,
and get
yes,
the high GPAs
yes.
and make the right networks.
Yeah, can I just remind the listener, you have this wonderful description of a social justice club at Yale, but it's incredibly hard to get into. It's an exclusive club that promotes inclusion.
They promote inclusion and they reject most applicants. Like everything is turned into a competition. And in fact, one of the things the book argues that I think is really important is if we want to understand these periods of great awakening, like we saw after 2010, what I argue is that the reason these periods of awakening, of this kind of rapid change in how knowledge economy professionals talk and think about social justice, these periods of really aggressive fighting over social justice and so on, the cause of them is precisely this kind of competition. They tend to arise during periods where elite overproduction becomes very acute, which is to say, when you have a group of people who have a reasonable expectation to be elites, who did everything right. So they went to the right schools, they got good grades, they majored in the right things and so on. And they're expecting to have a six-figure salary and to be able to buy a house and get married and all of that kind of stuff, get a good job. But the lives that they were expecting and taking for granted, it just turns out that society can't give that to them. Yeah. The conditions aren't right. When you have growing numbers of frustrated elite aspirants who find themselves in that position, where the lives that they were expecting just disintegrate or seem non-viable, then what they tend to do is indict the social order that they think failed them and try to tear down some of the existing elites to make room for people like themselves. And I argue, at bottom, this is actually what's happening during these periods of awakening. This is what they are at bottom, is these struggles within the elite, the kind of frustrated elite aspirants trying to leverage social justice discourse in order to enhance their own position and tear down some of the people to make room for people like themselves and to indict the social order that they think failed them.
Yeah, Donald Trump can't be the only answer. What is the answer?
You know, one of the things that's interesting, I argue that these periods of awakening, they don't ever really lead to meaningful benefit for the marginalized and the disadvantaged in society. What they do end up doing is enhancing the position of the political right, giving rise to alternative knowledge economy infrastructures like Fox News, or undermining trust in experts. But the thing about it is, even the backlash doesn't go on forever. And part of the reason the backlash doesn't go on forever is because typically the politicians who define themselves in opposition to us also end up alienating a lot of voters. You can see this, for instance, in the focus of Donald Trump on these kinds of cultural issues, things like renaming the Gulf of Mexico into the Gulf of America, or renaming mountains in Alaska, like they renamed Denali into something else. They tried to rename some of the bases that were changed because they were named after Confederate generals and stuff that were changed during the Great Awakening. They're trying to change the name back to the Confederate people again. They're still focused on this symbolic kind of stuff.
And maybe getting his own face on Mount Rushmore.
And so eventually, the people who voted them in because they were dissatisfied, because the Democrats were too focused on symbolic stuff, if all they get is more symbolic stuff and like the actual practical concerns that they had aren't being adequately addressed, then that's one thing that usually leads to the people leading the backlash getting thrown out. And another is that there's often overcorrection. So I'll give an example on immigration. So there's a lot of data that suggests many voters in America were dissatisfied with Biden's approach to immigration. And they thought he was too soft on immigration, that the borders were not tightly controlled, that there were problems that some migrants were creating in cities and other places that were not being adequately addressed by the government and so on. But if what they want is better enforcement of existing laws, and what they get is people being put into detention centers in Guantanamo Bay, family separation, raids on churches and schools, which is not what they want. When that happens, they tend to try to put back into power, at least to a degree, the very people they just voted out to act on a check on the people they just voted in.
Dr. Musa Alghabi, he's the author of the new book, We Have Never Been Woke, The Cultural Contradictions of a New Elite. It's out now in Australia through New South Press. Musa is also a sociologist at Stony Brook University in New York. Thank you very much for coming onto the program, Musa.
It was a pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
That's it for this week. Next week, Sam Tannenhaus on William F. Buckley, the charismatic Catholic who helped shape the modern Republican Party. A big thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and audio panel beater Roy Huberman. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.